Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Thomas Schwartz, author of the book Henry Kissinger and American Power. Tom, welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the program.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Okay, I grew up in Rochester, New York, had the privilege of going to some good universities, Columbia, and then a fellowship to Oxford, and then I did my PhD at Harvard University, and I've been teaching here at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, for the last 30 years. I'm the proud father of three daughters and a lifelong New York Giants fan. So those sum up some of my personal background.
What was it that led you to write a biography of Henry Kissinger, and what were some of the challenges that you faced in doing so?
Well, I was led to it. I had written a review, and Louis Mazur, the editor at the time of Reviews in American History, told me that he was involved in a project with Hill and Wang to do biographies of figures in American history, and the biographies would be designed to teach broader subject. And in this case, he said to me, can you think of someone in American history who would teach the notion of our diplomacy or foreign affairs? So I gave it a lot of thought, talked to a lot of people, and the one name that kept coming back to me was Henry Kissinger, that his biography really does encapsulate a lot of the issues related to the history of American foreign policy, American involvement in the world. And so I started. The challenge was that Henry Kissinger is probably one of the most documented figures in American history. His own memoirs run some 4,000 pages. He has written an enormous amount. He also kept records that gradually became available that are also extensive. He also figures very prominently in the 2 years of the Nixon tapes, some 3,700 hours of tape, and he's on there a lot. So those also were a source. And at Vanderbilt, we have something called the Television News Archive, which has been recording the evening news since 1968. And Henry Kissinger was a big part of that as well. So the real challenge was, in the end, trying to write a concise or short book or one volume biography of Henry Kissinger that could be accessible to a broader audience.
It was thinking, it was quite a challenge too. And it was something that, because I know what you mean about how Henry Kissinger is this very large figure in terms of American foreign policy. And yet it's fascinating to consider that he's only Secretary of State for 4 years. He is only National Security Advisor for 4 years. And yet he casts this enormous shadow over really the entire second half of the 20th century.
That is very much the case. I think he was also... The interesting thing is that's exactly right, and the focus of my book is on his time in government, and that's deliberate in part because that is where the records are accessible. Kissinger, after 1977, was a private citizen, and although there are records and materials related to his involvement in foreign affairs, and some of them are very interesting, those are not accessible yet. And, you know, Kissinger has his own official biographer, Neil Ferguson, who's now at Stanford but was at Harvard, who did a one-volume thing on Kissinger up to 1969. But in effect, I had to focus on the period of time in which he was in government. The shadow he cast, I think, is the fact that he was so influential over a large number of those who study foreign affairs and foreign policy. His ability to actually execute that policy became a sort of roadmap to many who tried to imitate it. It also became something that some wanted to avoid, they didn't like. So in a way, the ongoing period after 1977 was a continuing debate about what Henry Kissinger had tried to do in American foreign policy and the different approaches that many took to that.
Before we get into that, though, I'd like to take us back to his early years and talk mm-hmm. about some of those formative experiences and how it was that he is able to go from career in academia to becoming a shaper of foreign policy directly. What was his childhood like, and what was it that got him started?
Well, the fascinating thing about his childhood is I don't think you would have predicted that a German Jewish boy born in 1923 would end up being almost president of the United States at one point during his period of time. It was he was, in effect, a refugee from Hitler's Germany. They were able to come before things turned very bad. They left in 1938 when Kissinger was 15 years old. But he was someone whose early life was very disrupted by the rise of Nazism and what he saw to happen to his relatives and parents. The ironic thing is that this refugee from Nazi Germany, forced out of his country, comes back a few years later in the uniform of an American soldier and plays a role in the occupation of Germany, where he was actually directly involved with running cities and arresting Gestapo agents. His career can't be disassociated, you might say, from the events of the early 20th century, both in terms of what happened to the United States and its involvement in world affairs, and then our relationship with Germany, which was so important, and that played a role then in his transformation and career. And as a result of these experiences, rather than become what he looked like he was becoming when he first came to New York, an accountant, he goes on to Harvard University and studies history and meets mentors who are impressed with him and encourages involvement in a whole range of international activities, taking advantage of both his intelligence and his knowledge and understanding of Germany and Europe. And he rises through the ranks. He attracts the interest of Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York, who would become the governor of New York, and many people thought would be president, becomes an advisor to him, then ends up taking a part-time position in the Kennedy and then later in the Johnson administrations, and basically walks the line between academia and government during his early life.
I thought that notion of mentorship was interesting because you highlight those key mentorship roles that he mm-hmm. has. You know, first when he's serving in Germany, then in academia, and then and of course he perhaps this is a bit of an exaggeration, but he hitches his star to Nelson Rockefeller.
Nelson Rockefeller, yes,
and it definitely helps elevate his stature. How did he go from that association with Nelson Rockefeller to becoming coming under consideration for a position in the Nixon administration?
Well, I think the involvement with Rockefeller, and I think people have to remember that Rockefeller was such a significant figure. He represented at the time what was a large wing of the Republican Party. It may have disappeared by now, this sort of liberal wing of that party. But Nelson Rockefeller was someone who himself became ultimately vice president, almost became president. He was a significant figure, and I think Kissinger's role in that led him to be elevated as someone who was close to the center of thinking about American foreign policy. We had political polarization then, but not of the same type, and there was a center, and Kissinger was close to that by being attached to Rockefeller. And Kissinger was willing often to provide advice to Democrats as well as Republicans. In fact, I think sometimes that led to some controversies about his roles at the time. But his basic thinking about American foreign policy was very close to the orthodox views of most of the American foreign policy establishment, and that allowed him, I think, to work with Rockefeller and then ultimately then Nixon when he comes into office, to see him as perhaps the senior most Republican foreign policy analyst and to bring him into office.
What was the appeal to Nixon to bringing Kissinger in? Was it an attempt to reach out to those Rockefeller Republicans, or did Nixon read Kissinger's writings and find something sympathetic in a lot of Kissinger's thinking?
I do think he read some of Kissinger's writings, particularly I think they actually shared an admiration for French President Charles de Gaulle. Nixon also evidently had read Kissinger's early work on nuclear weapons. Nixon was familiar with Kissinger, but I think he also reached out to him as a way. Kissinger had all of the sort of establishment connections. He was at Harvard University. He was tied to Rockefeller. And this was a way, in some ways, for Nixon to reassure a lot of people within the foreign policy establishment that he was reliable. In fact, I quote, I think, one of the figures of that period, Adam Yamalinsky, who said, we'll all sleep more comfortably knowing that Henry is down in Washington with Nixon. Nixon was distrusted by a lot of the Harvard and Democratic policy elites and others as being too hardline, a cold warrior. Even the Russians, of course, also had that feeling about him at when he first came in. And I think Kissinger's appointment was a type of reassurance that he would follow a policy that would not be dangerous. Now, the other side of the coin, I think, is that Nixon also recognized in Kissinger someone who could bring foreign policy into the White House that would allow the president to use foreign policy for his own purposes, not defer it to the State Department, which Nixon distrusted and in which he did not thought was dominated by Democrats. And I think he did see in Kissinger's brilliance someone he could use to carry out foreign policy that he wanted to conduct.
So Kissinger comes in, and he comes in as national security advisor. What was mm-hmm. that role like in Nixon's White House? And what were some of the early challenges that Kissinger faced in it?
Well, it's an interesting role because the national security advisor is appointed by the president and answers to the president. He has a constituency, or she, and as the case with Condoleezza Rice, for example, who's the national security advisor for George W. Bush, they have a constituency of one. They deal with the president, and their power really is related to their relationship with the president. There was a secretary of state in the first Nixon term, William Rogers, who was a personal friend of Nixon, but in a way was pushed to the side by the fact that Nixon and Kissinger wanted to run foreign policy from the White House. And what Kissinger provided Nixon with was a person who could bring into the White House, and also because of his connections, bring a lot of advisors and others from Harvard, from other places in academia, who would provide the sort of expertise that normally would have gone to the State Department, but could then come into the White House as the national security advisor. In past, the previous national security advisors had been important, people like Walt Rostow and McGeorge Bundy, but they hadn't been as dominating as Kissinger would become because of his relationship with Nixon, and also because Nixon wanted foreign policy to be a presidential prerogative and also to be something that he could use for his political purposes. And Kissinger provided him with that. And one of the challenges for Kissinger was to be able to conduct foreign policy in a way that allowed or pushed aside the State Department, which did not want to be pushed aside. And so there were lots of bureaucratic conflicts, which Kissinger in his memoirs makes clear that he thinks Nixon actually enjoyed because it gave Nixon more power in the position of deciding between advisors. But he nevertheless used Kissinger very effectively during his first term.
And we're talking about a time when Nixon is elected president and Kissinger becomes national security advisor, where foreign policy is a very dominant subject in mm-hmm. American public debates. And of course, this where this is most visibly evident is with the Vietnam War.
Right, right. And that is when Kissinger and Nixon, when Nixon and Kissinger, and I think you have to keep Nixon in mind here because Kissinger was very much his subordinate during first term. When they come in, they are dealing with the fact that America has 500,000 men in Vietnam and no real strategy on what to do and where to go from that. And this had paralyzed American foreign policy. There was no relationship with China. relations with the Soviet Union had cooled considerably from what seemed to be a softening because of the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in August of 1968. Americans also had soured a foreign policy. American public opinion felt the United States was greatly overextended. Americans wanted to come home. America would later be a campaign slogan, but there was a feeling that the United States was spending way too much on military, more than half of its budget, and we had many social problems. The assassination of Martin Luther King had led to huge disturbances in American cities. There was a feeling that the United States had not done enough to deal with its racial, other inequality at home, and so it was a really challenging time to try to readjust American foreign policy, and that's what Nixon and Kissinger really faced in there when they first started.
You also mentioned in the book that there was he had this additional pressure in that he had campaigned on this, Nixon had campaigned on this idea that he had the secret plan to end the war in Vietnam.
And the war. Yeah.
And there was that expectation that Nixon would be able to achieve this. How do Nixon and Kissinger go about addressing the war in Vietnam? I mean, is there a secret plan? Does Kissinger have any ideas to how to end it? How did the two work together in what was not only a very controversial issue, but obviously also a very visible one?
Yes, and this is I think a very difficult one to wrap completely because it involves so many different issues. I think Nixon did have an idea of how he wanted to end the war, and part of it was based on what he had observed with President Eisenhower and the Korean War. Nixon was vice president under Eisenhower, and he saw what he thought was Eisenhower using the threat of escalation, even nuclear weapons, to force the Soviets and Chinese to pressure the North Koreans and everyone to come to some type of settlement. And I think Nixon thought he could end the Vietnam War by pressuring the Soviets or offering them incentives as well to pressure the North Vietnamese to end the war, and that the possibility of using that type of same technique would go ahead. The problem was the strategic situation had changed so fundamentally from 1953 to 1969 that this really wasn't possible. The Soviet Union was the equal to the United States in nuclear weapons by 1969, when in 1953 it had been vastly outnumbered by American power at that time. The Soviets were far more concerned with their rivalry with China than they were with dealing with the United States on Vietnam. And so the Nixon and Kissinger people tried to initially to try to get the Soviets involved, and that really failed. The whole linkage idea failed. Ultimately, the strategy that came up was really the one from Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird of Vietnamization, of basically gradual withdrawal from Vietnam and trying to place more responsibility with the South Vietnamese Army. While Kissinger did conduct secret and begin secret negotiations with the North Vietnamese, which I would argue ultimately were fairly futile. The North Vietnamese really were not interested in an agreement at that time. And so even though I think Nixon and Kissinger came in with the idea that they could, by taking various steps, for example, bombing Cambodia and trying to hit North Vietnamese units there in a way that Johnson had not, they thought, and then eventually sending troops in there, they thought they could end it early, and they found themselves really frustrated and unable to end the war as quickly as they thought they could.
You know, Vietnam looms large throughout that first term, but as you also explain, it's far from the only foreign policy issue that Kissinger is engaging in during his time as National Security Advisor. What were some of the other areas of concern, and what role did Kissinger play in shaping the administration's policy towards those regions?
Well, this is in the first term, Vietnam was dominating for the first few years, but there were other issues, and this was complicated by the fact that for example, in the Middle East, the Soviets had sent in large numbers of their forces into Egypt, and there was a war of attrition between Egypt and Israel. Now, Kissinger was barred by Nixon from dealing with the Middle East, but at the same time, Nixon had encouraged him to deal with the Soviets, and the Soviets were involved there. So it created a messy bureaucratic battle between Kissinger and Rogers over issues in the Middle East, where Kissinger was far more skeptical of any type of settlement that could be reached there, whereas the State Department was pushing for some type of an arrangement there that would provide a settlement between Egypt and Israel and its and other Arab countries. Kissinger was also brought in to deal with the crisis that developed over Chile and the election of a Marxist president there. Nixon did not want that to go ahead and put Kissinger in charge of plans to try to undermine the election of Salvador Allende and prevent him from becoming president. Europe was also an area where Kissinger dealt with the Germans. The Germans were interested, particularly after the election of Chancellor Willy Brandt, wanted to reach out to the Russians to try to get some sort of settlement in Eastern Europe, which the Nixon administration both on the one hand welcomed, on the other hand did not want the Germans to get out of the possibility that Germany might be lured by the Soviets in some way of weakening its ties to the NATO alliance. So all of those issues were also part of the early period of the Nixon years, where they were trying to balance off, trying to end the war in Vietnam, trying to establish a new relationship with the Soviet Union and arms control, and also Nixon's interest in some type of opening to China. But I make the case that on the whole, most of their initiatives in the first period were largely unsuccessful or counterproductive, as I would argue with Chile. But that in effect, the Nixon doesn't begin to achieve many successes until the second half of his first term.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And that's where you get to this remarkable period that you describe as the trifecta, which is this, mm-hmm. you know, this series of foreign policy triumphs in 1972 that make for a optimal run-up to Nixon's re-election effort. What was the trifecta, and what was Kissinger's role in bringing it about?
Well, the trifecta was Kissinger's comment that the three achievements, China, Russia, and Vietnam, would be part of the way in which Nixon would be reelected in a landslide. China was not something that initially Kissinger was very optimistic about, but Nixon really should be given more of the credit, and some people would argue now the blame for opening to China, but Nixon was the one who recognized that the Soviet Union and China, who fought a border war in both in 1969, that manipulating that relationship could benefit the United States. And so in the spring of 1971, the Chinese indicated a willingness to discuss this. The Chinese were willing to discuss it publicly. Nixon wanted to keep it secret. I argue not just because of a fear of right-wing reaction, but because he wanted, in a sense, to use it as an electoral issue, because he knew that I think the opening to China could be vastly popular with Americans who would like to see the United States have more flexibility in its foreign policy and also have fewer enemies. And in effect, Kissinger carried out the secret trip that began the negotiations with China. In July of 1971, Nixon truly stunned the nation when he mentioned that he would be visiting Beijing. This had an almost immediate effect on the Soviets, who had been dragging their heels about any type of meeting with Nixon to discuss the nuclear arms issue. They suddenly now recognized their need to have a summit and agreed to meet with Nixon and to accelerate the preparation for a nuclear arms agreement. And the combination of the relationship now between the United States, China, and Russia now began to isolate North Vietnam from its principal allies. This didn't stop the North Vietnamese, of course, from launching a military offensive and trying to bring down the South Vietnamese government, but they found that they did not have the same degree of support from the Soviets and Chinese, and this ultimately, I think, led them to a willingness to negotiate a final, like, some type of an agreement with the Americans. This all came together in 1972 with Nixon's extraordinary trip to China, then his trip to the Soviet Union, despite the fact the United States was now mining North Vietnamese harbors and bombing the North to prevent them from taking the South in 1972. And then the decision of the North Vietnamese to drop their demand that the South Vietnamese government be replaced. And Kissinger's famous press conference, the first time he did a sort of public press conference where he said peace is at hand right before the election. So it was the trifecta played a big role both in foreign policy achievement, but also in the domestic political struggle and Nixon's landslide victory.
So Nixon wins the second term, and it seems like Kissinger is very much at the heart of affairs as national security advisor. How is it that he becomes Secretary of State? And frankly, why does he want to become Secretary of State if he's proving to be so influential already by being close at hand to Nixon?
Well, I think that is kind of an interesting question, and I make an argument in my chapter that Nixon and Kissinger, other people have made the case that Kissinger would have been, Nixon would have gotten rid of Kissinger in his second term. But in fact, I argue that no, Nixon was planning to use Kissinger again, both in the Middle East and Europe and other places, to continue this policy of having foreign policy success build up his political strength at home. Then Watergate. And Watergate had this enormous impact, destroying Nixon's political capital in the United States, reducing him very quickly in his popularity. And ultimately, Nixon seized on Kissinger's role as a successful figure and as an extraordinarily popular figure. Kissinger was one of the most admired Americans in the polls in 1972 and the most admired in 73 and 74. And Nixon seized on Kissinger's role. And Kissinger ultimately wanted, in a way, to have a power base separate from Nixon. As I mentioned, National Security Advisor has only a constituency of one. The State Department role was far more sturdy in that sense, and Kissinger got both. In effect, he's one of the only figures to serve as both National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. He wanted that, in a sense, that sense of independence from the president, confirmed by Congress, being able then to be in an official position in the American government that I think was much stronger. And Kissinger wanted, I think, to become Secretary of State and use that position then to carry out foreign policy when Nixon was crippled by the Watergate scandal. And this would be very important. The role of Secretary of State would be very important to Kissinger's role, particularly in the negotiations in the Middle East.
You actually mentioned something that I want to go back and cover, which is the notion of the idea of Kissinger's popularity in the country, because this is something that we're getting a little bit further away from. You know, nowadays, you know, most people probably couldn't name who the Secretary of State is. Probably couldn't name who the National Security Advisor is. But as you described throughout the book, Kissinger had a public stature that really was quite extraordinary. I mean, we're not talking about like it was a different time. I mean, back then, Dean Rusk was nowhere near as popular. Walt Rostow was hardly on the cocktail circuit to the great Nixon that Kissinger was. But Kissinger he wasn't just a political figure. He was very much of a celebrity.
He was a celebrity. That partly came from the China trip, although he had courted the media in Washington quite deliberately from the very beginning. Henry Kissinger's extraordinary charm and an incredible sense of humor. He is a very interesting person. Many in the media, I think, deferred to him. There was the sort of sense the Harvard professor, he cultivated media. He called journalists. He spent a lot of the time. One of his aides estimated he spent between 30% and 50% of his time on the phone with journalists and media figures. He cultivated their support providing them background information, leaking them information when it served his purposes. And this then escalated in a sense when he became the figure of the China policy and then sort of the out front figure for Nixon's foreign policy in 1972. He played a little bit with this, with his glamorous women that he would escort to various functions, some of which was all a bit for show because Kissinger was in a very serious relationship with a woman he eventually married. But he did court the idea of being a celebrity, and he was a very colorful figure in administration that seemed to be dominated by men in suits and blue suits and not very interesting. And I think he took advantage of this. The media landscape was very different. You only had the three television networks. They were all based in New York. He cultivated relationships with all the news anchors and all the rest from the television media, as well as the New York Times and Washington Post, and he received very favorable coverage, and he became a figure of great renown. And as I say, the Gallup poll found him at the number one in 1973 and 74.
Yet, as Secretary of State, you describe that he was facing a lot of increasingly more intractable challenges. You mentioned the Middle East. There's also some other issues. What was he doing as Secretary of State, and to what degree did his role change, if at all, once Nixon was replaced by Gerald Ford?
Well, I think this is one of the areas where I'm trying to – I think for a time when Nixon was particularly crippled by Watergate, Henry Kissinger was running American foreign policy. I call him actually the president for foreign policy. And his strategy in the Middle East, his efforts to arrange a settlement after the Yom Kippur War between Israel and Egypt and Syria, and to shape a Middle East that was dominated by the United States, that the United States would play the role of mediator, arms supplier, the United States would be the dominant player there, and force out, effectively force out the Soviet Union, which had been courting Egypt and other Arab countries during that time. And then this was central. And now, of course, we have to remember that the Middle East was also much more strategically important at this point because of the oil shortage and the oil boycott that took place, that suddenly all Americans were suddenly affected by the fact that there was an oil boycott against the United States. Prices rose 400% of the price of oil. The energy crisis of the 1970s brought foreign policy home to Americans. So Kissinger's role in the Middle East and his emphasis on it as Secretary of State was also connected very much to concerns that Americans had about the position of the United States in the world and about the American economy and America's viability in the energy sector. And so Kissinger played a key role in that. Now, when Gerald Ford comes in, when Nixon finally resigns, Ford really had immense admiration for Kissinger. I kind of used the joke that the relationship between Ford and Kissinger could be summed up by the fact that Gerald Ford thought Kissinger was brilliant and Kissinger agreed with him. And they basically, that relationship was very, Ford really did defer to Kissinger, sometimes to the point at which his political advisors thought was bad because it made him look weak. They thought that Ford comparatively did not look like he was in charge of his administration, that he had allowed Henry Kissinger to run his foreign policy, and they would later, Jimmy Carter would actually campaign on that. But Ford and Kissinger worked better together because I think Kissinger did like Ford more genuinely than he liked Nixon. He never felt very close to Nixon, whereas I think he genuinely liked Gerald Ford, and they worked together, and Ford had a difficult time sort of reining in Kissinger, but he had immense respect for him and allowed him basically. There were very few things in which Kissinger lost any debates or arguments about foreign policy during the Ford period. This was very much Kissinger's foreign policy during this time.
At the same time, though, you talk about a lot more bureaucratic infighting. It seems that while Ford admired him more and maybe even backed him more, that basically people were much more openly gunning for Kissinger. I'm thinking of Schlesinger, Rumsfeld. How you're starting to see the sense that Kissinger is no longer someone who is unexpected or who is able by virtue of having that heavy access to the president to be able to influence things behind the scenes. People can see Kistner coming now, and they prepare for him accordingly.
That's right. And in fact, there was substantial discussion, especially as Gerald Ford's political situation grew difficult, that he should get rid of Kissinger because he was facing a conservative Ronald Reagan in the primaries in 1976, who argued that Kissinger had been too conciliatory toward the Soviets. And so there was pressure on Kissinger during that time, and lots of and many Republican leaders argued he should resign. But Ford stuck with him. And I think if Ford had eked out a win in 1976, and he came very close, he would have kept Kissinger as his Secretary of State, because Kissinger, I think he did ultimately think Kissinger's running of American foreign policy was very effective and nuanced and creative. And he dismissed some of the more what he saw as nationalistic criticisms by Ronald Reagan and arguments that he had allowed America to decline.
Yet when Ford loses and Kissinger leaves the Secretaryship of State, he had he still has that enormous stature. And what's fascinating is how you describe how that plays out. I mean, he is still in many ways very much a celebrity. And as you also point out, he's still relatively young. He's only 52 when in 1977. Yeah. And there's this expectation that he's going to continue to play this outsized role. And here I was thinking about what you talk about earlier in the book, where you reference like the wise men, you talk about Dean Acheson, and how these you still had this idea of these statesman figures who were oftentimes able to still play a role in American foreign policy. And yet the decades that follow are ones in which Kissinger still has this, you know, very visible presence. He is, you know, very much in the media, but he never gets back into the circle of power again. And why exactly doesn't he? And what does he do with all of this, the stature, the celebrity, this status that he has?
Well, this is, I think, one of the most interesting things. I think during the Carter years, people thought Kissinger was going to come back as Secretary of State. And certainly Kissinger thought himself, I think, he was going to come back in some form as Secretary of State for the when the Republicans won in 1980. I quote from a Reagan insider who told John Chancellor, the NBC News anchor at the time, that we do not want Henry Kissinger on the cover of Time magazine. There was this fear that Kissinger was too dominating a presence, that he had reduced, if he were brought into any administration, he would diminish the power of the president. He would be seen as central. So even though Kissinger himself adjusted his own political views to accommodate Reagan conservatism and a harder line on the Soviets and other issues, Ronald Reagan consulted with Kissinger, but he did not appoint him to any a significant role until he brought him in to chair his Central American Commission in 1983 and 84, where he was trying to gain bipartisan support for his policies in El Salvador and Nicaragua. And Kissinger served briefly in that role, but then was then left it and, you know, provided that report. And then Kissinger, the only other time in which Kissinger might have come back into government was as the head of the 9/11 commission report. He was appointed by George W. Bush and resigned less than 2 weeks later because of all the conflicts of interest from his business associations that would have to be disclosed. So Kissinger remained, I think, influential in his opinion pieces, in his commentary role, in lots of discussions that he would have. Whenever he went to China, he always met with the leaders there and then prepared a report for the president. So he remained this towering sort of figure in international politics and business who provided advice but could not be brought in a direct leadership role, even though his ideas were often quite important, or at least seen by administration figures as something they wanted to listen to.
There was also another aspect that you write about, though, that I thought was even more fascinating, which is how so many times in American history, you have people who leave office and whose statures grow. People, basically, the estimation of them grows. I'm thinking of, like, you know, Harry Truman, Dean Acheson, and so forth. And whereas with Kissinger, after he leaves office, he's this, you know, celebrity figure. You describe how he's, you know, the most popular person in America in the mid 70s in some polls. And it seems that, you know, as you go on into the 80s, into the 90s, Kissinger becomes much more disreputable. I'm thinking, Hitchens' book, and to where, having him on a panel in the 1980s seemed to be a good thing, whereas the idea of putting him on the 9/11 commission seemed to be much more controversial from the get-go.
Absolutely. No, he and part of this is that the revelations of some of the issues that had come up and the degree to which some of the Kissinger legend did not match up to the reality as we saw the papers and heard the tapes and got into the history of that period. It got much more messy. Kissinger was a figure who compromised on many issues and who also did not have the same sensitivity to issues, for example, of human rights, particularly in Latin America, in the case of Chile and Argentina, and other issues that many Americans felt should be central to American foreign policy. So that Kissinger's own, the fact that he, as the historical record got out, it became much more a complicated picture. And the ways in which Kissinger had tried to shape the narrative of his time in office through his memoirs became much more problematic. And so historians and others began sort of taking down some of that image. He also became a figure of great controversy on the left. William Shawcross's book on the Cambodian bombing and the idea that Kissinger's role in this particularly, and then the subsequent tragedy of Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge and the genocide that went on there, was the responsibility of the Nixon administration for bringing the war into Cambodia, also became a part of this argument. Revelations about Chile and the role of covert operations there, the arrests of political prisoners, all of this became part of a new narrative as Kissinger's role became far more controversial, and people began using the idea that Kissinger was a war criminal, that he should be brought up. Christopher Hitchens, who was probably one of the most effective polemicists in the English language, really took on Kissinger quite dramatically in his book and then the documentary, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. And so it became Kissinger became sort of a subject of intense controversy. I make the case here that I think some of this is related to the fact that Kissinger also so personalized his role in foreign policy and so exaggerated, you might say, his own personal control of events and the degree to which he was responsible for things, that it was not a surprise that in a way people came to think that he was responsible for a horrific body count of people who were suffered during this period. When in fact, I think the responsibility is far more mixed, and the United States plays a role in some of this, but much of this also is because of events in these countries themselves. So in a way, Kissinger's fame also became part of the connection to why he became so controversial and so and was seen so antagonistically by a large number of people in the politically liberal or on the left.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes, I've been doing some work on, you might say, my early work was on NATO and Europe, and I've become far more interested in the way in which the United States tried to deal with peace in the Pacific, particularly its relationships with countries like Korea, Japan, China, nationalist China, and others, trying to understand and recognize what was going on in Asia in the 19... I've gone back in time a little bit to my earlier work on alliances work on, you might say, the relationships with allies who were not countries you could, in a sense, bring together the way NATO brought Western European countries together, but you needed to have both bilateral relationships and then try to have some sort of security strategy. It's gotten me into some of the issues involved with Korea and Vietnam and the comparison between our relationship with both countries. In fact, I would like to do a piece on particularly the year 1963, where the Kennedy administration faced comparable political crises both in South Vietnam and in South Korea. We know a lot about what happened in South Vietnam and the overthrow of the Diem regime. We don't know a lot about what went on in Korea, where there was much more of a successful outcome, where the United States was able to persuade the leader there to accept a election and to go forth in a democratic path.
Well, sounds like some very fascinating work and something that could, again, push the boundaries of what we know. So I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Tom Schwartz, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. Hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.